Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Who is January Jones? She is not a young, beautiful, talented actress on Mad Men. She is not an older, gorgeous, exotic dancer from the Johnny Carson Show. She is an author, and she wrote, Thou Shall Not Whine, the 11th Commandment, that reached number one at Amazon.com. She is a reality TV golf personality with World High Stakes Golf televised on HDNet. She is a humorist and winologist expert. She is your featured host today on January Jones Sharing Success Stories. So sit back, relax, and get ready to laugh and listen to Ms. Jones with her eclectic roster of guests as you learn life's lessons. These stories plus sharing equals success. Welcome, and remember, beware, because you are entering the no-whining world of January Jones.
Now let me ask you a question. Are you a middle child? Can you imagine being 23rd out of 46 children in one family? Yeah, that's really amazing. That's really putting you right in the middle when you're number 23. Have you ever wondered about life in a polygamous family? Can you imagine having one father and six mothers and 45 siblings? Have you ever wanted to escape a terrible home life? Tell me, when was the last time you heard about a fantastic book called What Peace There May Be? Now, would you like to meet someone who has some of the answers that we're looking for? Now, are you ready to learn how to be successful? If you can answer yes or maybe to any of these questions, then you are in the right place, and I would like to welcome you to January Jones Sharing Success Stories. Today I will be introducing you to my guest. She's been on the show before, and she is a fantastic success coach. She will provide us with wonderful, informative, and inspirational lessons and some really, really great advice along the way. Also, I'm pleased to announce that our show now has 1.7 million listeners to date. Also, LinkedIn has announced that my profile was one of the top 5% most viewed during 2012. Now let me tell you a little bit about my guest today. She is the 23rd child of 46 children in the quintessential middle child. Growing up in a Mormon fundamentalist polygamous home shaped her life values and her views on literally everything. She is the author of What Peace There May Be, which was a finalist in the 2010 Indie Excellence Awards in the memoir category, and she received honorable mention in the 2011 Reader's Digest Self-Published Book Awards. This memoir is about growing up while suffering abuse in a polygamous family living in Utah. The author says, in writing the book, I let the rotting parts of myself die, and I ask the book to carry the emotional truth that my body could no longer hold. My guest didn't know anything other than the family environment that was created for her, a system without regard for society or man's laws. She was raised in a sequestered home in a busy city neighborhood. Everything beyond the front gates was off limits. This coming-of-age story is such a testament to survival as it is to surrender. Pushed to the limit of her coping abilities, she tried everything she could think of to bring about the peace that always seemed out of reach. And now she finally has found that peace, and I'm happy to welcome back to the show Susanna Barlow. Hi, Susanna. How are you doing this evening?
I'm wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for having me on again.
Oh, I'm so thrilled to have you on. You know, I've had you on the show one other time, and I was so impressed with your interview, so impressed with your fantastic book, It was a brilliant memoir that I have included you in my latest book called Priceless Personalities. And you are chapter 3, which is an unforgettable chapter that I hope everyone will read. Now let's talk about what it was like for you growing up as the middle child in a family with 46 children.
Well, I think that it had some advantages and some disadvantages. Now that I'm raising my own children in a much smaller family, and the struggle I have sometimes as a parent to take care of each one of their needs and be able to give them each the time that they deserve, I've realized how I survived on almost no nurturing parent-child relationship. And so it was more than just having a lot of people. It's there needs to be enough adults to give to each child what they need. And that's what I didn't get growing up. And sometimes it was great to just be anonymous and to just be one of so many that you could just blend into the background and not be seen. And sometimes that's really a survival technique, a camouflage effect for avoiding trouble and just being able to be part of something bigger than just you. Sometimes it was a safe haven, and other times it was isolating and very lonely.
Oh, yeah. Now, how old were you when you realized that your childhood was very different from most other people's, or did you ever realize that? When did that come about?
I think on a conceptual level, I understood that the families in the apartments across from us had different families, but I didn't really get it until I had my own family. I didn't really know how to make a comparison because I didn't have anything else. And while sometimes we would watch TV and I did get to see families on TV, I didn't know if those were accurate representations or if they were just, you know, TV. And so I think it took having my own kids before the whole of my childhood stood out in stark relief to me.
Well, once you had your own children, is that when you started to write your memoir?
Yes, that is exactly when I started to write it, because my kids are really the reason that I sought help for myself. And writing a book was one step along that path of helping myself, of working through some of the emotional traumas and being able to deal with what happened to me. One of the most damaging aspects of my childhood was not what happened to me, but that it was kept a secret. And anybody who's been in a secretive, abusive home or family or environment knows that it's the secret that is the poison. And that's what makes it so impossible to heal from while you're in that environment. So being able to come out and reveal the secret and work through the shame that is so connected to secrets and especially abuse, that it's just, it's more than cathartic. It's life transforming.
Now, did you have, obviously you had a lot of mental abuse, but did you have physical abuse too?
Oh, yes, very much physical. Every form of abuse occurred in that house, and I believe that it grew to that proportion because of the secrecy of the environment. And nobody knew how to handle it, and so it was just suppressed, ignored. And it just got bigger and bigger until it was out of everybody's control. Even, you know, the wife that was the main abuser, she was out of control. The whole situation was. And
well, did anyone stand up for you against this wife that was out of control? Did perhaps your real mother, or did anyone take a stand against her when this was going on besides you?
For me, no, nobody did. I had a brother once who stood up to her. He it used to be beat with this plastic tube. And it was extremely painful, and it often left, I mean, it always left, you know, big old bruises, and, you know, your body would swell wherever you were hit, if you were hit repeatedly. And so there was one time that he actually grabbed his stick out of her hand and raised it, threatening to hit her with it. He didn't actually follow through and hit her, but he showed her, you know, well, you can't do this. I'm big enough to stop you. And he ended up running away from home shortly thereafter.
Oh, I've heard that said, that a lot of young boys in the polygamous community do run away, or else they're sent away. Did you find this to be true with your other brothers?
I felt like the abuse was the force that drove them away. I did have a lot of brothers run away, and part of the reason I think this is true is because they had access to the outside world, because they got involved in jobs or in some way making money outside. And all the daughters never left. They were in the home until they got married, and the responsibility of that daughter was transferred from father to husband.
Oh,
so I think the boys got out. They had a sense of what was out there. And so they were able to run away to something that was in some way connected to their life. And for me, it was just a great big abyss of terror. I didn't know what was out there, and I couldn't even fathom leaving.
Now, what kind of what did your father do for a living? I mean, it must have cost a lot to raise a family of 48 people. What kind of an income and what kind of a job did he have?
Well, he worked several jobs. When I was growing up, he worked and started his own water softener business. And we just lived very poorly. And he made it work. He refused to get on a welfare system or abuse the government programs. He felt that that was wrong, and that's, I don't think that that's typical for a lot of the way the media presents polygamous families abusing the system. And there are some that do, for sure, but my father felt that that was wrong, and he did not do it.
Now,
I was quite young. One of his wives, the first wife, actually took a job and began bringing in income that way as well.
Okay, and then, of course, the boys were sent off to work. Now, talk about, share with us your relationship with your older sisters, because you wrote about it so, it was so beautiful in the book, the way you described how the older sisters would actually do the nurturing instead of the mothers.
Right, and I think this is partly due to the fact that I came along so much later. Some of my older siblings, the first family, if you will, the women lived separately. They lived in separate houses.
Oh, really?
And so during that period, my older siblings remember this relationship with their mother. Well, around the time that I was born, or shortly before I was born, then my father consolidated all the wives, the children, the family into one home. So the only thing I ever knew was this big conglomerate. Where your mother was just one of the other mothers, and all of the older sisters were given responsibilities to take care of all these kids, which was now far too many for one mother to take care of, especially when you have another one outside the home, you know, trying to work.
How many rooms did this house have?
Well, there was, oh, I want to say roughly eight.
Eight bedrooms.
We were crammed into bedrooms pretty tight, you know. Sometimes seven or eight beds in one room. Bunk beds that were stacked three high. A lot of my older sisters slept on the couches, and older brothers in sleeping bags on the living room carpet, and you know, so it was just, we were just stuffed in there. But to get back to the relationship I had with my older sisters, Mother to me.
Susanna, let me just take a break, and we're going to hear about your host. And when we come back for our next segment with Susanna Barlow, we are going to talk about her relationship with her sisters and what would happen when they would leave and go off to their own homes and their own marriages. We will be right back with Susanna Barlow. Have you ever met someone who was unforgettable, someone who has touched your heart and soul? People who have faced difficult problems, people who fearlessly shared their stories, people who have priceless personalities. I've been fortunate to host a talk show called January Jones Sharing Success Stories, and it's been my privilege to interview hundreds of guests. In my new ebook, we're talking about people dealing with problems such as incest, molestation, child abuse, drug abuse, and even polygamy. Then there are my guests dealing with physical struggles such as blindness, cancer, and birth defects. All of my guests have been exciting, eclectic, and energizing. I look forward to sharing them with you in my new ebook, Priceless Personalities, Success Stories Shared by January Jones. The introductory offer of $4.99 is now available at Amazon.com. Order it today. And tonight we're sharing a priceless personality whose interview is in the book, Susanna Barlow, and she is the author of What Peace There May Be. Susanna, let's go back and talk about your wonderful sisters. How many sisters did you have, and how close were you to them?
When I was young, there was, I want to say maybe 5 to 7 older sisters. Mm-hmm. That served as mother figures.
Uh-huh.
And some of them were as young as 13. But in my mind, because they were in a caretaking role, then I bonded with them in a way that was more maternal than that of a sibling. And they literally were the first person that I saw when I woke up in the morning, and they were the person who tucked me in bed at night. They bathed and combed our hair. They read stories. They told us how to be and how not to be. And they laughed with you, cried with you, kissed your boo-boos when you got hurt. And they were this comradeship of nurturing and love. And they loved you. You were their own. You were their family.
Oh, yeah.
And when they left, when one of them got married, I was about three or four when the first one got married.
Uh-huh.
And I remember being so upset and angry that she just disappeared. And I asked my mother, where did she go? And she said, well, she's gone. She got married. And
I said,
but she can't leave. She can't leave me. And she said, well, she'll come back once. Collect her things, and you can see her then. And she did, and I, the minute she walked in the door, I went and climbed on her lap, and her husband had his arm around her, and his hand kept touching my shoulder as I was sitting on her lap, and I would pick up his hand and move it. Like, get away from her. This is my sister. You can't have her. Well, she gathered her things and left, and I don't really have any memory of her coming home again, or I might have seen her in other kinds of settings, but the intimacy and the connection and the sense of belonging was completely cut and erased.
And how old was she when she got married? Do you know?
She was 16.
16. Wow.
And so I began to harden myself after that experience. And the next one that got married was probably a few years later, and and I was just crushed, absolutely crushed. I didn't know how I was going to live my life without her. And then 6 months later, another one's gone, and 8 months after that, another one's gone. And I literally felt like the whole stability of my childhood was just falling apart.
Right.
And I went into the closet after the fourth or fifth one left, and I was crying. My mother came and was like, what's your problem? Why are you crying? I said, they're all gone. They're getting married. And she didn't seem very understanding, and she said, well, they have to. They've got to live their own lives. But to me, and I couldn't figure it out as a kid why I felt the way that I did. It was just so upsetting to me, and I think I just developed a hard shell around myself to protect myself from that kind of loss ever again. It's been a lifelong journey learning how to open up again, learning how to get close to people and letting myself be vulnerable enough to be hurt like that again.
Right.
And it's been a huge part of my learning and path.
Your environment as a young child, obviously there was no privacy because there were so many people and you were all just in the same rooms sharing everything. And then you had a real insecurity with people just disappearing. And the hardest thing is that you never get to see them again.
Right.
Why is that? Do the families not socialize or intermingle, or what kind of a social life did your family have?
There was a little bit of socializing, but the philosophy that I was raised with, and you have to remember, I was born and raised in the 70s and the 80s, and polygamy at that time was very different than it is today. Like all civilizations and cultures, it evolves over time, and I think this trend that I'm going to describe is one that is not as prevalent today as it was when I was growing up. When a daughter gets married, she no longer belongs to her family of origin.
Oh my God. She
is adopted, like being adopted into another tribe, into this other family. She takes the name. She is now subject to the husband. Thus, the husband is subject to his father. She is now part of a completely different family structure. And she is not to maintain deep relationships or really connected relationships with her family of origin. She is no longer part of the family. It felt more like a death and a very, very painful loss of them as they would leave. And they were just beaming with joy as they were leaving. They were getting married. It was so wonderful for them. And everyone they're leaving behind is just crushed and crying and upset. And I did the same thing. I left all my little brothers and sisters hiding behind couches and chairs, crying and asking why I had to leave. It was the exact same process. It was this idea of, you don't belong to this family anymore. You belong over there. And when you don't have individuality, which is something that is minimized in the polygamous cultures, then who you are as a person isn't nearly as important as how you fit into the larger group and how you fit into the families and what's your little spot, you know, which cog do you fit in to make the whole thing go around. And as they left, they were literally adopted into another family, and that was that. The sons, on the other hand, brought women from other families into our family. And so I gained sort of adoptive sisters who then became part of my circle. But they weren't, I wasn't connected to them in a maternal and nurturing way. Mm-hmm. And by that time, I was completely walled off and unyielding.
You know, because I was thinking about what it would be like for your parents, and they've got daughters who are married off and they never see them again, some sons who run away, but yet they still have, they continue to keep having more children, so there's always more people coming into the family, and then the sons bring wives in and they bring their children. So it does stay as a large family unit, but it's just a lot of people are missing from the circle, aren't they?
Right. And my mother told me when her oldest daughter got married, that was one of the most traumatizing experiences she ever had. And she lost a child to death. And so she was someone who could speak to it. And she said it was so painful. And she saw her, but she wasn't really allowed to be her mother anymore. You know, we saw each other at church functions, and but she always kept a distance, and she would say, they belong to that family now. And I'd say, well, can I call her? And maybe on her birthday, you know, like trying to keep it minimal, trying to cut this natural familial bond that isn't supposed to be severed.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very unnatural and painful thing.
Right. Right. Now let's talk a little bit about homeschooling. Who was the teacher? Were your sisters your teachers, or was your mother your teacher? How did homeschooling work for you?
Well, it started out with all of the older, you know, several of the mothers and the older girls would take a role teaching a different subject. But it became too confusing and too hard to keep track of the education. And so my father put the abusive mother in charge of the education, which I have yet to figure out why.
So there was this one mother who was the only mother who was abusive, and she was in charge of homeschooling. That does not sound like a good situation.
No, it was a terrible situation. And she was something of a perfectionist, and so she brought that high demand to the classroom, and, you know, very unrealistic expectations. We were just given mountains of work to do, and it escalated to an out-of-control place pretty quickly. I mean, it wasn't probably even 9 months before we were being locked up behind a padlock and keys into the schoolroom, where we couldn't be let out because we had not fulfilled her request and what she thought we should be able to do. Recently, I was cleaning out a closet, and I found some old school papers.
Mm-hmm.
My kids were sitting around, and I started pulling out this material and showing them assignments that I had done and different grades that I had gotten on them, and their jaws were on the floor. I can't believe you did this. You were only 9 years old, and, you know, and I'm looking at it and realizing how
insane
and impossible it was to accomplish what we did, and how amazing it was that I did as well as I did. And yet there was a constant beating. This is when the beatings really escalated, and it was probably 2 or 3 a day. And,
oh, my gosh.
And if it was a good day, then I didn't get one.
wow. Oh, dear. You know, we're going to
take... And that included being fed. You know, if I didn't get fed and I didn't get a beating, it was still a good day.
Yeah, and in your book, you talked about being so hungry at one point that the children would eat paper.
Right. Oh, yeah, that was... We lived on paper. I don't think anybody really knew what we were doing. We didn't even realize it. You know, as kids, you just take life at face value. Whatever's put in front of you, you just deal with it.
Yeah.
And we had that old computer paper, just reams of it. And we would just grab a piece off and pass it around, and everybody would start eating. And we didn't think to ourselves, oh, this is lunch. This is our replacement. Our mind didn't even go to that place. It was about survival. I'm hungry. This is something that I can chew and swallow, and it doesn't taste too bad.
So,
and
isn't it interesting?
A little bit better.
Isn't it interesting how those survival instincts kick in? You know, we're going to take a break and have a commercial. And when we come back with Susanna Barlow, she's going to share her website information with you and tell you how you can get her book. Also, when we come back, Susanna, I want to talk about your relationship, your discovering the Declaration of Independence and how that changed your life. We'll be right back with Susanna Barlow.
Could your commute or daily exercise routine use a boost? When was the last time you really got the giggles? This is Adele Park, author of Yikes! Another Quirky Audiobook, inviting you to tune in, turn on, and let loose a few good laughs. Yikes! Another Quirky Audiobook is about a marijuana enthusiast named Blue McKenna who gets involved in a reality TV show as a way to cure an apocalyptic case of writer's block. A conglomerate of kooky contestants invades the polygamous community of Naval, Utah to compete in a reality show called Yikes. Things get sticky when Blue McKenna's hemp garden is ignited during an ill-fated seance. Find out what's going down in the desert in Yikes, another quirky audiobook. Visit www.yikesaudiobook.com to learn more. That's www.yikesaudiobook.com.
These are wonderful books. I've listened to both of them, and if you're on a road trip, they're fantastic to play in the car. Susanna, could you share your website information and tell my listeners how they can get your book?
I'd be happy to. My website is www.susannabarlow.com, and I have a whole lot of articles and a bunch of my writing on there. My book is available through my website that links you straight to Amazon, but it's also available through BarnesandNoble.com and, you know, most of the online book retailers out there. And so you can find it just about anywhere online.
It's a
e-book format as well as,
As
well as hardback and paperback.
Well, I have to tell everyone listening that when I got the book, I started reading it, and I just read through the night. I didn't put it down because it was just such an amazing journey. It was so well written. I can see why you got so many awards. How did you become such a wonderful writer?
I don't really know.
It's a gift.
I think I just had something to say, and I still have something to say. I think I was born with a passion for language and for communicating and for helping people understand the world through words. And I've always been very sensitive to verbal communication, and when people speak, it's like I can sense what they're not saying as much as I can sense what they are saying. And it's all been a very important part of my life. And so I think writing just seemed like a fit. It just sort of fell into my life. And I started writing. And, you know, the only obstacle was lack of education. But lucky for me, I didn't even know that that was an obstacle. So I didn't view it as an obstacle. And I just began plunging ahead and reading and writing and
share with us. Share with us having to memorize the Declaration of Independence. I think that's such an amazing story.
Well, I think one of the unintended side effects of the education that we received is that we were actually exposed to quite a bit of material. And one of the assignments that I had when I was 11 was I had to memorize the document. It's not the entire document, which is very lengthy. It's really just the first large paragraph, outlining what the colonies intended to do. So that section of the Declaration of Independence, I was supposed to memorize the entire thing. I couldn't eat or have any privileges or be let out of the schoolroom, except, you know, bathroom breaks, that sort of thing, until the document was memorized and I could say it in front of the mother that was in charge of teaching us without any mistakes. This was pretty daunting to a little kid, and nobody ever taught me how to memorize, and I didn't know very much about it. But as I was going over and saying these words over and over and over, I began to hear certain words just stood out, and words about rights, human rights, and how people should throw off these governments that were tyrannical, and that they should be given their freedoms, God-given rights, not man-given rights. That it stirred something in me, and I don't think my 11-year-old mind really fully comprehended what was being said in this document, but my heart resonated with it. There was something, some spirit of the document that I connected to. And I felt this almost this passion rising up in me as I would say these words. And in the very end of that first paragraph, it talks about when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object defenses is designed to reduce them under absolute despotism.
Mm-hmm.
It is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and provide new guards for their future security.
Wow.
And that was the last line. And, of course, I still remember it. It's powerful.
Well, it certainly is powerful.
It was telling me to throw off this abusive person that was a tyrant, mm-hmm. and provide myself with new guards, new protections for my future security. It sent chills through my body when I would read it. I was like, this is telling me something. This is so relevant to my life. And I think that that's an experience not very many people have as they sit there, and if anyone has even read the Declaration of Independence.
Right, yeah.
But when they even think about it, they don't think about it in a relevant, personal way. It was personal. That was me. It was speaking directly to my life and my situation. And I think that's really profound.
Oh, yeah. That's definitely an aha moment there. Now, how old were you when you contacted a newspaper journalist who was outside your home and you made contact? Would you share that?
Well, I was 14.
14. Okay.
Yeah, and I think that there was this whole string of experiences, starting with some of these school experiences, that kept pushing me to the outside world. Like, what is it out there? I have an insatiable curiosity anyway, mm-hmm. that got me into a lot of trouble. but in this case, it kept pushing me out. What's out there? And I loved reading the newspaper, even though it was my mother did not approve. I had to sneak the newspaper in the house under my dress, mm-hmm. and sneak it into the bathroom, and I'd read the whole thing. And then I'd roll it back up, put the rubber band back on it, stuff it back under my dress, and run back out in the driveway and throw it back out there with no one the wiser. And while I was doing this, I read these columns. And I started really connecting with the author of the columns, the journalist, and I just got this harebrained idea to write to him, to contact him, and I didn't even know what I wanted to say. It was more like, am I alive in both of these worlds?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Could my voice be heard out there, too?
Right.
Am I someone more than in this little pocket?
So you sent him a letter, and he responded.
He did. In the newspaper, he responded to my letter, which was a problem. I ended up having to steal that whole section out of the paper. And later that evening, my mother and father are looking over the paper. Now, where's this section? Why is it missing? And they were about ready to call the newspaper and ask for a new one. And there I was under my mattress.
Did they ever discover this relationship?
Yes, they did.
They did.
One of my siblings felt compelled to tell them. She was very concerned for my welfare and believed that I was doing something really bad.
Uh-huh.
And so she told my father. And he was pretty furious and scared. Mm-hmm. And he really tried to impress upon me how dangerous this was, that I was inviting disaster. You know, he was brought up, and so was my mother, in an era where there was, FBI agents assigned to surveillance of polygamous families, and people were taken to prison.
Yeah.
They lived in a very frightening and secretive time, and so here's this naive 14-year-old daughter calling some newspaper guy. I mean, he was just totally undone, couldn't believe that I had done it, and didn't understand why. And he said, what are you getting out of this relationship? Why are you doing this?
Uh-huh.
And I said, he listens to me.
Mm-hmm.
He cares about me.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you think he cares about you more than your own parents?
Oh, wow.
You know, and I'm thinking, duh. You know, but of course you can't say that to your parent who has just posed a question like that. You know, you give them exactly what they want to hear. But in my mind, he was a link to my own sense of worth, when the rest of my value as a person was being literally stripped away, corroded, and chipped off as something that was unwanted, and I could hardly keep a hold of it. And he really provided me with a connection.
And what a brave thing that was for you to do. And I can certainly understand how your parents would have reacted, because at that time, polygamous families were worried about the fathers being put in jail, and it was a big threat to everyone. You know, we're going to take a break.
Homeschool was illegal as well.
Yes, exactly. We're going to take a break and have a commercial. And when we come back, I want to talk with Susanna about her new books that she's writing, and I want to ask her what success means to her now and if she has any regrets or advice for our listeners. We'll be right back with Susanna Barlow.
Second time around can be better. Second timers try harder. Looking to have a rewarding second marriage? Any marriage. Read Successful Second Marriages by Patricia Bubash. She interviews a variety of couples that have succeeded in their second attempt. Each story reflects that the second marriages can be tough going, yet be the best of the best. Learn from these couples who share their intimate stories, how they struggled with difficulty and have thrived. Stories such as, "Our kids drove us apart. We separated 5 times in 4 years. 4 months into our marriage, my 85-year-old father-in-law came to live with us. 1 year into our marriage, I was diagnosed legally blind. Death of my eldest child brought grief, depression into our new marriage." Successful Second Marriages is encouraging, hopeful, inspiring. Available on Amazon.com in book form and ebook. Read Pat's musings at www.successfulsecondmarriages.com.
Susanna Barlow. And Susanna, before we talk about your new books and your new projects, I'm sure my listeners want to hear from you how you left your home and what became of your life and your marriage and your family. How did you navigate that treacherous experience?
Well, that was a big, quite frightening experience for me.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I think many people don't realize is when you leave the polygamous culture, and I think this is true for any culture, there's a huge loss of community, identity, and your sense of belonging is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to find my way into a world that I didn't really understand and that didn't understand me, that was a long journey, and that's really what my second book is about in a lot of ways, is finding love and learning how to find my place and how I fit into the human story that we all share, and that I don't need my little small tribe because my people are all of us. And so I initiated myself into the tribe of human beings, and found myself that there was a place waiting for me that had always been there and always would be there.
Yeah, could you briefly share how it was to stand up to your father when it was time for you to get married?
Well, he was used to guiding and directing his daughters toward their marriages, and and I went to him and said, this is the person I want to marry. And he's like, well, who are you to come up with that? You know, and I said, well, God told me, and God said I should marry this one. So do your thing. Get on it. Make it happen. Wave your magic wand, whatever it is a father do to make daughters disappear. I'm ready.
Well, I think that's quite brilliant to say you got a message from God. That's, you don't get any higher.
That's the top authority.
Yeah, you can't argue with that one.
I wanted control over my marriage and who I married and when I got married and all of that. And so I waited until I was 20, and I consulted him about it when I was 17 and said, here's what I want to do, but I'm going to wait until I'm 20. And he said, why? Why do you want to wait? And I said, I want to be ready. I want to be emotionally mature and be able to stand up to my husband if I need to. And I really felt like if I was still a teenager, I wouldn't have what it took to stand up if I needed to. And I was prepared to fight my way toward freedom and equality. Once I got out, I was not going to look back.
What has your family's reaction been to the fact that you've written this book? Do they know about it? Have they read it?
Well, some family members have and have been supportive. Other family members refuse to read it. And, of course, my parents, they know about it. It was very upsetting to them at the time. And you can imagine it brought up all their old fears of prosecution for polygamy, et cetera.
Sure, sure.
But nothing terrible came of it in terms of law enforcement and all that. So they've kind of let it just be water under the bridge.
Is your husband from a polygamous family?
Yes, he is.
Okay. So he's
both left the culture in our early 20s.
Okay.
And
so
he led the way and I went along.
Oh, wow. That is such an amazing story. What does success mean to Susanna right now, today?
I think it means being true to this moment, whatever is in this moment, and not defining it by what you should have done or what you could have done, but what are you doing now? To me, that's the success that I look for in my own life. And not to say I don't look back and think, oh, if only I had done this or that, stop myself and say, what a waste of time.
Because
this is where the power is, right now.
In the moment.
And I do with right now is what makes me a success.
Oh, what an amazing legacy you are creating for your children. Your new book is going to be a memoir, and as soon as it comes out, I want to have you contact me so we can have you back on the show. Also, you're working on a fictional series of short stories about polygamy, which is another, I would love to read that and share that with my listeners. What do your six children, what do they think about your career as a writer and their life with parents who are in a polygamous family? Do they know about it?
Oh, absolutely. I refused to raise my children in this kind of secrecy that I was brought up in, and that includes hiding my shameful past as I once viewed it. I felt very ashamed of it, and it was... I wanted to hide them from it. I wanted to protect them from it. And I realized that I was going to create the same environment, one of secrets, that I so despised. And so I have made it wide open. We've had great discussions about child abuse, arranged marriages, everything, you name it. And they actually have relationships with some of their cousins from these polygamous families. I want them to see it. I want them to see where I came from. I want them to know the choices that I made, and I want them to feel empowered to not get stuck in the judgmental mindset of someone who was raised outside of it. And I also want them to be free and not feel obligated to be connected to it outside of family relationships. And so it's been a wonderful thing, as scary as it was. I'm really, really grateful that
you are
that into their life.
Right. You are truly one of my priceless personalities, which is why I decided to share you with my fans in my latest book. And I hope that as soon as your new books and series are ready, that you will contact us and come back and visit with us again.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I'm going to be posting all of my short stories one at a time as I complete them on my website for free reading.
Okay, well, keep me posted, and we will definitely share them with our listeners. To our listeners, we hope you've enjoyed this show today. Isn't she an amazing gal? You know, my upcoming guests for the rest of the week are all just as exciting, eclectic, and energizing as Susanna. They will amaze, amuse, and they will astonish you. We love sharing our stories, struggles, and secrets for success. Now, I want everyone out there, remember my mantra. If you think it, then you can do it. So for now, dear friends, I want all of you to stop whining, start smiling, and then start sharing our show with everyone you know. And if that doesn't work, then start eating chocolate, lots and lots of chocolate. Again, thank you to Susanna. This is January Jones thanking you for joining me today on my journey and reminding you to take care and stay safe.
We want to thank you for listening to January Jones Sharing Success Story. Always remember Ms. Jones' personal mantra, if you can think it, you can do it. That's what all of our guests have done with their lives, and so can you. You are the ultimate success coach in your own life. All you need to do will be to start sharing your own story with your family and friends. We hope that our guest stories will encourage you to explore an equation in your future that will combine your creativity, plus connecting with others will enable you to be successful too. Always remember, your passion plus your purpose will equal prosperity as you explore the wonderful world of January Jones.
Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Who is January Jones? She is not a young, beautiful, talented actress on Mad Men. She is not an older, gorgeous, exotic dancer from the Johnny Carson Show. She is an author, and she wrote, Thou Shall Not Whine, the 11th Commandment, that reached number one at Amazon.com. She is a reality TV golf personality with World High Stakes Golf televised on HDNet. She is a humorist and winologist expert. She is your featured host today on January Jones Sharing Success Stories. So sit back, relax, and get ready to laugh and listen to Ms. Jones with her eclectic roster of guests on Blog Talk Radio as you learn life's lessons. These stories plus sharing equals success. Welcome, and remember, beware, because you are entering the no whining world of January Jones.
Now
let me ask you a question. Can you imagine growing up in Hollywood? Doesn't that sound like fun? Or can you imagine your dad running Columbia Pictures under Harry Cohn? Have you ever wanted to hear about producing or directing a movie? Have you ever wanted to hear the inside story? Tell me, can you imagine having Frank Sinatra as your godfather? Wouldn't that be great? Tell me, do you know what it takes to survive in Hollywood? Yeah. And when was the last time you watched the classic movie Somewhere in Time? It's everyone's favorite. Or better yet, would you like to meet someone who has some of the answers that we're looking for today? Would you like to learn about old Hollywood? If you can answer yes or maybe to any of these questions, then you are in the right place. And I would like to welcome you to January Jones Sharing Success Stories. Today I will be introducing my guest. He is a Hollywood from the legendary Hollywood family, and he will provide us with wonderful, informative, and inspirational lessons about his life in Hollywood and some really, really great advice and some of the inside stories. I'm pleased to announce today that our show is featured on the front page at Blog Talk Radio as a staff pick. I am honored to be a featured host, and we now have over 1 million wonderful listeners. Also, LinkedIn has announced that my profile was one of the top 5% most viewed during 2012. And thank you to all of you who went out there to view me. Now, let me tell you about my guest today. He was born into a successful Hollywood family. His father, S. Sylvan Simon, was a producer-director who made films with such stars as Abbott Costello, Lana Turner, and Red Skelton. He worked as both a producer and an executive at Columbia Pictures under the legendary Harry Cohn, producing such films as Born Yesterday, the 1950 film that garnered a Best Actress Oscar for Julie Holliday. Sylvan Simon died when my guest was 4 years old, an event which compelled Frank Sinatra to become his godfather. His mother remarried Armand Deutsch, a film producer at MGM who produced films with such stars as Robert Taylor, James Stewart, and Grace Kelly. In more than 35 years as a producer, director, and production executive, my guest has been involved in the production of over 20 films. I am pleased and honored to welcome to the show today Stephen Simon. Hi, Stephen. How are you doing?
I am doing great, but I have to tell you, I'm still laughing from the introduction to the show. And I completely made a mistake. I thought you were the exotic dancer from the Johnny Carson show. I'm surprised that you're not.
You know what? My husband wishes I were.
I have to tell you, that is a great introduction, and I can't even begin to tell you how much I love the No Wine Zone. I just think that's great. So it's wonderful to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you, and I can tell that you're not a whiner. You know, one of the themes of my show is success stories, and we like to have our guests share the failures so that people can understand that there's a lot that goes into getting to be successful. Some things are not that terrific. Your chapter one in your book, The Old Hollywood, Nothing Succeeds Like Failure. That's a great title. What prompted you to write that?
Well, I think it's true. I think it's true very much when you're involved in creative endeavors. If you're pushing the envelope and you're involved in the arts in any way, it's really kind of hard to imagine once you've lived a certain amount of life that you haven't crashed and burned more than once, yeah. That you haven't failed more than once, that you haven't gone through at least a few dark nights of the soul. It's if you're not doing that, if that hasn't happened, then you're probably not pushing things. You're probably staying in a very safe place. And I happen to be one of those people that does not shy away from the concept of failing. And I have failed in my life. I've done things that have crashed and burned. I've been through a bankruptcy. I've been through all kinds of really difficult things. You know, I've been fired 3 times from movie positions and things like that. And I think that those are things that teach you lessons that are invaluable later in life. And I think it's very important to embrace those failures and not... I know there are some people that say, well, nothing is really a failure because if you learn from it, it's a success. Well, that's true in retrospect.
Yes.
You know, that is absolutely true in retrospect, but it doesn't help when you have actually crashed and burned, when you've done things like I've done, which is make movies that you love that no one went to go see, or get fired from a job, or lose everything and have to start over again. Yeah, those are all great things in retrospect. When you're going through them, they're failures. They hurt like hell.
Mm-hmm.
And you do learn from them, and hopefully you don't repeat them, and then they ultimately do make you a stronger person and get you prepared for the next time.
Sure. And the thing about your life in Hollywood, your failures, they're so public. That's so much more difficult. A lot of us, we have our little failures in life, and it's no big deal. But when you're in Hollywood, oh, my gosh, it's just right out there. Everyone knows about it. They talk about it, and it affects your life in many ways. That's a hard part.